Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Michael Connelly is the author of 40 previous novels, which include the Harry Bosch series, the Lincoln Lawyer series, and the Renee Ballard series. A former newspaper reporter who has won numerous awards for his journalism and his novels, he is the executive producer of 4 television series, Bosch, Bosch Legacy, The Lincoln Lawyer, and Ballard. It is a great pleasure to welcome Michael Connelly to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you.
Thanks for having me back.
So give me a sense of the Mickey Haller story, where we are now, and coming to this point of working on a civil case.
Well, in the last time we saw him was a book called Resurrection Walk. And when he finished that book, or when I finished that book, in the last few pages, Mickey comes to a realization that he needs to have a major pivot in his life. He has to find a new direction. And so a few years have gone by since that book came out. And now we find him as a special, a public interest lawyer, where he's now kind of the aggressor or the prosecutor, if you will, in a series of lawsuits, and we center on one in this book against, as you say, a big AI tech giant.
He seems to transition to this relatively well, in the sense of the learning curve is not that great.
Yeah, I would agree. I think there's a little bit in the book about him, going from criminal to civil, and then saying that's a misnomer because there's really nothing civil about these kind of clashes when you get into court. And so you see him doing a lot of the same kind of moves he made in criminal court in terms of dealing with witnesses and a strategy against the lawyers going up against him and picking a jury even. A lot of the same things are at stake or involved, but now I think he feels like, hey, I'm representing a lot of people here. It's one case, but there's other people who are going down these pathways, and I'm supporting them all.
What has it been like to see the transformation of this character, especially from that first novel?
I think it's been fun. I think there's been 8 books about him, and I think he's evolved through every one. He's still been a guy who can, to borrow someone else's description of him, can dance in the rain and not get wet. Between the raindrops, and I think that's a pretty good description of him, and he would probably agree with that. But I think he's looking for a higher meaning in his life, and this is a case where he thinks he can get that. Previously in the books, he's defending one person accused of a crime, and so whatever his success rate is, it's for that one person. But here, I think he feels that he's watching out for everybody when he makes his case.
And it seems as though there's great knowledge that he has as to what's happening, what's possible in a technology that is still often unknown. I mean, he obviously learns a lot along the way, but the concerns are there initially.
Yeah, I mean, what happens with, I mean, this is why I like writing about him. It's the first time, not the first time that I've written about a new technology. And there's always this shakeout period where the government sits on the sidelines and kind of watches and decides when and how they will come in with regulations. But until that point, it can be very competitive. There can be billions of dollars at stake. And when that happens, what often slides are ethics and common sense. And so I think this is a case that really comes just down to common sense. Why are we giving chatbots coded by people in their 20s and 30s to 13-year-olds? And isn't that a recipe for some disaster? And, that's what his case is about.
Given that AI is changing every day, at what point do you dive in and say, okay, well, now would be the time to write about that? Now would be the suitable time to write, where it's still somewhat people know about it, and yet the Wild West is still somewhat applicable.
I can only tell you my story on this one. About 4 years ago, there was a case in the United Kingdom where a young kid jumped over a wall at one of the palaces with a crossbow, and he was going to hunt the queen, shoot the queen with an arrow. And he was, quickly apprehended. Nothing happened. But when they delved into what motivated this, they found he was urged by a chatbot. So when I saw stories about that, I thought, like, that is really interesting. And we're probably going to get more of these type of cases. And then last year, there was another case, a really sad case, where a kid committed suicide. And that spawned a lawsuit against a large tech company that created the chatbot that this kid was very immersed in, and was, committed suicide because this chat companion, told him we could live in eternity in this other world. So that spawned a lawsuit. I got that lawsuit. I got a copy of it. It was very long because it had a lot of transcripts of the discussions he had with his robot. It was almost like a blueprint. So that when I read that lawsuit, I said, okay, now I'm going to write about this part of technology. And as you said, it's still shaking out. AI is moving so fast, and you see a lot of stories about this. My biggest worry when I was writing this would it have any relevance when the book finally came out?
Right.
And so that was a risk. But we moved pretty quickly. I finished writing this book earlier this year, and it came out in October. So I think I beat the antiquity of it.
Yeah, the issues are the issues. You have one where you're writing about an ethicist that you find an ethicist is working at the AI company, and the person that Mickey is talking to, who we'll get to in a second, all these AI companies have them now. A lot of the time it's simply for window dressing, CYA stuff, but sometimes not. Technically, they're supposed to monitor ethical standards and guardrails in the development of their AI programs and products. Have you found that? I mean, the one thing you would hope that over the time since you've written the book that that has improved, but it doesn't seem to be going in that particular direction.
Yeah, I mean, the frequency of stories of these kind of tragedies is increasing, and so that to me is the biggest measuring stick. The case of the boy who committed suicide in Orlando, like, got lots of press because it was almost unique. Now that kind of story is not unique anymore, and almost I don't think a week goes by that you don't hear about something, a near atrocity that was avoided or one that wasn't avoided. And so we're still in that period where, as you say, or as I say in the book, or as Mickey says, it's kind of the Wild West.
Michael Connelly is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is The Proving Ground, a Lincoln Lawyer novel, and it is out from Little Brown. You bring in Jack McAvoy and returning as both an observer and a participant. What makes him the right character to pair with Mickey Howler of wanting to write a book? But also, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but also agreeing to a lot of the parameters that Mickey sets down and saying, oh, okay, that's fine. I'll go with that.
Jack, it was kind of interesting because Jack is the character. He's a journalist or a former journalist now that I've always used when I want to explore a new technology. So I wrote a book about him way back 30 years ago, when there was this new thing called the internet. And then I used him to write about DNA analytics and data, the cloud and things like that in prior books. So this was, this AI stuff was a prime technology for to get him involved in, but I wanted to do a legal case, so I gave the story to Mickey Haller, and then I thought, let's find a way, or let me find a way to bring Jack into it because this is his thing. This is a pitch over the plate to him, and I think he could be helpful to someone like Mickey Haller, who, as you said, is learning about this fast-moving science as it's happening.
And the fact that he has very specific things that he wants and doesn't want, and having a journalist around while he's doing the case. Jack is up for all of that. He agrees to all of those conditions, which I think journalistically speaking, I think you would agree is rare. But in this case, it's really interesting because they both seem to be on that same page.
Yeah, I mean, I think he sees the greater possibility here. I'm talking about Jack, that he does have to like sign away his life almost. But it's either a take it or leave it. And I think he knows this is a watershed case, just as the real case that spawned the lawsuit that inspired this, I think will be a watershed case when it gets to trial, because I've been tracking it and I know what's going on there. And a lot of the moves made in that case were made here. So I mean, in the novel. But the back to Jack, I think it was he did take a take it or leave it proposition, but I think he saw the possibility of what this could be.
His role really evolves as he digs into the discovery documents, and that is a journalistic instinct, right? And it certainly helps with the unfolding of the plot.
Yeah, I think he is a journalist's idea that a lot of stuff could be hiding in plain sight. And Mickey Haller comes to him and says, "Look, I'm drowning in the discovery of this because they've tried to drown me with so many documents and so forth that I've asked for in discovery." And he knows Mickey is smart enough to know I need an expert to start looking at this stuff, and it looks like Jack McAvoy might be that expert. So it kind of turns them loose on the 12 terabytes of discovery, which is just an awesome amount of work. And he very quickly kind of looks beyond the beyond and gets a very significant clue by just looking at who has been left out of emails. So even though it's a big technological company and all this stuff is going on, Jack makes a critical get by just checking on emails.
And you introduce a whistleblower to this, and it's fascinating because those insights become pivotal. And I'm curious as to what interested you in looking at the risks and the pressure faced by someone who is working for the tech company but realizes that trouble is brewing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the world of the ethicists, that they're not necessarily I mean, they're hired by this company, but they're not supposed to be the company's friend. They're not supposed to rubber stamp everything. They're supposed to hold up the stop signs. And that's got to be a very difficult position to be in, when you're working for that company and you're paid by that company and you hope to advance and get raises and all these type of things. The decisions to like say, wait a minute, we can't go down this way, or wait a minute, this is wrong. Is a pretty tough place to be. And so when I started reading about ethicists in the AI world, I really got a kind of a sympathetic reaction. And just being a writer, knowing there's something here I could do something with that I think would be pretty interesting.
Tell me about the cage of that being the headquarters, if you will, of Mickey Haller and what he is working on with those on his staff.
Well, I think half of it's paranoia and half of it's good or smart paranoia. When there's so much at stake, the future. I mean, people say AI is the future, so the future's at stake, and there's billions and billions of dollars at stake. Mickey is smart enough to know that when so much is at stake, people are going to cross lines, and so he takes whatever measures he can to secure his side of the operation, to secure his team. And so they build a what they call a Faraday cage, which is basically a copper wrapped room where they can work and there can be no technological intrusion. Their emails and their discussions and so forth can't be picked up by outside technology. And and when you're writing a book, I mean, that kind of stuff is kind of window dressing, but it's important. It kind of underlines what's at stake. And it's just something that Mickey did, possibly a little bit for show, but also for the reality of the situation that he's in.
You've talked a couple of times in our conversation about your reading of these particular issues and of these cases and what cases may move forward and how they may move forward. How much of that research do you want to do in going into it, and how much do you want imagination to take over as well?
That's a pretty good question. I maybe I'll say half and half. I mean, I love going into a courtroom and watching how things operate. And, it's often not what you see on TV and so forth. I like what happens when the court is not in session, and all that stuff is really interesting to me. So I enjoy that. But I also, when I sit down in front of the laptop to start writing, I really like my imagination to fly. And that's where I start thinking of what if this happened or what if it went this way, I keep using that word pivot. You got to have pivots all through the book, and most of the time those things come from imagination, not something I've seen while sitting in a courtroom.
Obviously, I've read a lot of crime novels. I've read all of your work. There's something that when you're reading about the case and you're reading about the what's going on in that courtroom that is just riveting. And it seems as after all of these years that you are still interested and fascinated by it.
Yeah, I really am. I'm not a lawyer, but I covered courts when I was a journalist, but that's decades ago. But I still have some friends, have a couple judges that alert me when they have something interesting in their courtroom, and I'll sit in as much as I can. I also always like to be writing, so I don't spend a ton of time in it. But it's still, to me, it's a fascinating thing because I kind of get at this in the first page of this book. It's like, the square, this cube, the courtroom, you go into there and there's some really interesting battles that take place. And, usually everybody, there's winners and losers, but usually everybody's been damaged in some way. And that to me is grist for really good storytelling. So I just remain very fascinated in it and thankful that I get to do this.
And in that first page, Mickey is saying, and to him, it was always been more of an octagon where you go in, beat the hell out of each other. There's brutal contact, and then one person comes out, perhaps bloodied, but there's only one person who's going to come out.
Yeah, that might have been overstating it, the octagon, but I liked it when I wrote it. But I've had a, since the book came out, I had a few like my judge friends saying like, "Come on, it's not that bad." But and when you write these books, you're automatically writing yourself into a corner because your job is to bring drama and story and to, as you use a very nice word, you use riveting, make it riveting. But the reality is, when you're dealing with a reader, it's all going to head to the same thing, guilty or not guilty, or finding for the plaintiffs or finding for the defendants. And that really undercuts the stakes when and also they know, hey, this guy's writing this book, this guy's not going to lose. So you got to find other ways to keep the drama going to that very last, to the very last minute.
Michael Connelly is our guest on the book show this week. The new novel, The Proving Ground, published by Little Brown. We mentioned your work in journalism and you're starting out in LA and working as a journalist for many years. And I know you and I have talked about this in the past, but the novel, your fiction is so grounded in journalistic detail. That being a journalist helps you in the writing and making you a better writer, a better crime writer.
Absolutely. Yeah, we wouldn't be having this conversation if I hadn't spent those years as an ink-stained wretch, as they called us back then. Yeah, I mean, it not only it gave me so many things. It gave me a work ethic that I write every day. I don't get writer's block because you just don't have that when you're working at a newspaper. It gave me a writing style. The less is more writing style. And I think it gave me an ear for dialogue and an eye for detail. And I think that's one of the clear things that readers are looking for. They're just looking for truth, and even though they're reading fiction. And so when I can explain a little bit about how a system works or doesn't work, a legal system works or doesn't work, I think that's a way of connecting to readers and keeping them so they'll check out your next book.
The idea of the jury in this book and jury selection and who you get and how that works. I mean, obviously that's pivotal in all court cases, but the way you look at it in this is really interesting because it's obviously looking, as we have talked about, an issue that is important, an issue that many people don't completely understand and realize. And yet there is this idea of what it is like. The thought of what it would be like to lose a child as the result of something and explaining that.
Yeah, I mean there's a lot of like dancing in the rain for Mickey, but it comes down to someone who's had like a terrible, unrecoverable loss, and you got to keep track of the emotions of what has brought everyone in here in the first place into this cube or octagon or whatever we're going to call it, and that's really important. On one side, I keep talking about the billions of dollars that still are at stake, but there's also human life that's at stake. And Mickey's client in this, she's already lost everything. She lost her daughter, but what her goal is to make sure no one else loses their kid. At the center of this, Mickey might be a slick operator, but his client is somebody who's trying to change the world for the better. And that evens that kind of stuff out with Mickey.
I was I'm not gonna give anything away here, I don't think, but I was struck toward the end where the trial is over and Mickey's walking out and is surprised that there's not more media around. And I thought that's interesting because it's a case that is of such importance and we're talking about it as a cultural issue and something that is a technological issue, a cultural issue, and in this case in life and death, and yet that hasn't permeated into a great interest. I mean, partially there aren't that many journalists left, but still, it would seem like it would be something that would be fairly necessary to talk about and write about.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And that was a decision I made, and I think it had something to do more with the way, yeah, we don't want to give stuff away, but the way things ended. In my mind, I thought some of the media would check out and move on. And also it has something to do with the timing of of his press conference and things like that. But I wasn't really looking to make any kind of statement about the media.
Having spent so much time covering cases like this, of how they are covered now, and what do the people, what do the citizens, what do readers, what do those who are interested, what are they finding out, and what are they not finding out?
That there's not as many journalists, and you can extrapolate there's not as many platforms. The media has changed so much, it's become very polarizing on the big stages. And a lot of the media tentpoles, community tentpoles, like a really solid newspaper, radio station, etc., they're going away, and they have been going away. And so I just don't think it's a better situation when, people are fed, what they want to hear rather than what they should hear. And so I think that's an ongoing problem. And that, since we're talking about an AI case, even that is getting us further into trouble when things are presented to us through the AI filter. Yeah, you don't get a full story. I guess that's the bottom line, is you're not getting the full story anymore.
You're, of course, writing the books, and as I mentioned in the introduction, you're executive producer of four television series, Bosch, Bosch Legacy, The Lincoln Lawyer, and Ballard. What does that role, in practice of executive producer mean?
In practice, that's a good way of saying it. Yeah, it looks like I'm like Mr. Hollywood, and I'm really busy. And I'm not. I'm accorded those credits because I write the books, and they can mean anything. I know of executive producers. I mean, I one time had an executive producer on the first Boss show for 3 or 4 years, and I never even met him. But then there's executive producers are there every day, and they're running the show, and they're making major calls in terms of spending money or in terms of editorial content. So it's a really hard animal to get your hands on. Personally, for me, it just means I get some oversight. I get scripts early on. I give comments on scripts. Sometimes I write scripts. I visit writing rooms. But the bottom line, and which is what I explain to everybody when I go into a TV production with someone or a studio, is that I write books, so I'm the guy who's kind of fueling these shows with my books, and that's got to be my priority. And when I have time to visit the set or visit a writing room or to take part in that or to write half a script or whatever you want me to do, that all's going to have to come after I my day as a book writer.
I was talking to Margaret Atwood recently for an interview of her new book, and she was talking about working with on Handmaid's Tale, and she said basically my job is to when I have the conversations with the team in place, it's basically I tell them who I don't want to die.
That, I mean, that's what I mean. It can mean a lot of different things.
The most part, they listen to her.
Yeah, I mean, they have to spread the storytelling out when it comes to television. So there's all kinds of stuff that is in these shows that are not from the books, and they're from other people's creative minds. And a lot of that gets run by you. I'm the keeper of Harry Bosch, or I'm the keeper of Renee Ballard, and I want to make sure that stays intact. But when they bring in other characters, or they come and say, for example, this character is going to be gay, are you okay with that? That kind of stuff is, run by me all the time. Most of the time, I say, whatever you want to do, unless it comes to the main character. It's a very lucky position to be in, where you can kind of call your own shots in terms of what kind of time you put into it, and where the level of questions you want to be filtered out before they get to you.
Michael Connelly is the author of the new novel, The Proving Ground. It is published by Little Brown. Michael, it's always a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me again.
Michael Connelly is the author of the new novel, The Proving Ground. It is published by Little Brown. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.